Hey everybody, and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway Podcast. Yes, we're back, and we are joined by the wonderful Richard Guy today, everybody. Welcome, Richard.
Good morning, thank you. Thanks for your time today.
Well, it's a pleasure, and the tag team today is myself and, of course, the lovely John Curtis. John, welcome, mate. How are you?
Thank you. I'm extremely well and excited because we're going to learn some stuff today.
Well, we are. But let's be honest. We almost cancelled this guy, didn't we? He was a bit of a rogue last time. So, for full transparency, everybody, we had a little tech failure. But Richard fell foul of that. But we've got him back because he was that good that we want to do it all again.
I prefer and the council here, story rather than the headphones not working. So,
yeah. Well, you are a bit edgy, and we will discover that all today. But Richard, listen, it would be great just to get a little bit of context. Who are you and where are you from? What is your day job? And so on like that. Give us a bit of insight.
Right. Well, I'm Richard Guy. I'm the fleet and plant director at AAMI. So within the AAMI organization, we've got a fleet of about 4,000 vehicles, which is roughly 1,500 cars, 1,500 vans, and just under 1,000 trucks. And my responsibility with the team is the procurement and in-life management of that vehicle fleet.
Wow. So that's a pretty big responsibility, I think it's fair to say, in this current world. The electrification obviously is overtaking us in terms of, you know, cars, vans and trucks. Give us a picture of where you're at with that whole process.
Yeah, well, it might be worth just giving a bit of an introduction to the AAMI organisation as well, because it's probably a name that a lot of people have heard of but don't necessarily know what we do. So we are one of 39 strategic suppliers to UK government. So we do a lot of work with central and local government clients. And like most organisations, we're split into business units. So whether that be the highway sector, where we carry out highways maintenance work on behalf of organisations like National Highways, Transport Scotland, various county councils, local authorities. We also do a lot of work in the rail sector as well for Network Rail and also the Transport for Wales on the Core Valley lines. But we've also got a facilities management business called Complex Facilities, where we do a lot of work with the Ministry of Justice to maintain the prison estates, and also Ministry of Defence, where we maintain a lot of the housing stock and the MOD bases. And we've also got a consultancy business as well that do a lot of advisory analytic work, design traffic schemes, etc. So we work in a number of different environments, which again gives probably added pressure when we come to decarbonisation of the vehicle fleet, because a lot of the vehicle fleet is used in operational delivery. So the highway sector, for example, you know, a lot of the vehicles that we use are used to actually deliver the service as opposed to getting people to site. So the complexities that we've got within the transition of the vehicle fleet are, yes, it's quite numerous. They've always got different applications that they can or can't make to work. So in terms of where we are at the moment, it's probably worth going back in time a little bit on our decarbonisation journey, because I suppose like any large organisation, we were probably guilty at one stage of just trialling everything. We didn't really have a strategy around this. We just trialled whatever we could. Something new and shiny comes onto the market, we try it, maybe buy some, didn't really know how to make it work. And a couple of examples of that, we had a number of electric smart cars going back as far as probably 2007, 2008. We had some of the MODEC vehicles as well. Do you even remember MODEC?
Yes.
Yeah, no, great. Yeah. And this is in the days when you had to lease a vehicle from one organisation, lease the batteries from somebody else, and then one went into administration, which meant you couldn't use the rest of it anyway. So really, really difficult stuff. And it's no wonder that nothing really stuck in those days. As things moved on, particularly with the advent of some electric cars, we've got a fixed choice car list for most of our driver population. And we put some electric cars on the choices list as well, but didn't really put a lot of thought into it. It's just, well, let's put some on the list and see how they go or not. Not surprisingly, take up was fairly low. And even then, when you start getting in vehicles like the iX3 and some of the Polestars and Teslas come onto it, again, take up was fairly low. And I think by the time we got towards the end of 2022, out of our 1,500 driver population, we probably had less than 60 cars that were electric at that stage. Now, end of 2022 was fairly significant for us. Because we went through a change of ownership then. We had 20 years of being owned by a Spanish construction company. And then we went into the world of private equity. And none of us quite knew what that was going to mean for the business, let alone our sort of fledgling ESG strategy at that stage. But the one thing it did do is really emphasize where we need to focus our efforts on this. The first thing our new owners did is put in an ESG committee. And that, to make sure it had the relevant traction in the business, was chaired by our chairman, Lord Colin Moynihan. And what Colin Thew was, you're a strategic supplier to UK government. You've really got to be leading by example on all this. And having 60 brave souls driving around in electric cars isn't really going to show that you're leading by example. So they set us a tough target, trying to get 75% of our car fleet to be electric by the end of 2025 and 25% of our commercial vehicle fleet by the end of 2025 as well. Now, bearing in that stage, 60 cars was less than 5% of the fleet, and we had probably 10 or 11 electric vans at that stage. So having a big target to get ahead of us for 75%, from 5% to 75% within what was going to be about a three-year period was going to be a tough challenge. So we had a bit of discussion internally as to how we try and do that. Now, the easiest thing to have done would have been to mandate the use of electric cars, because we could have done that. It's a fixed choices list. Drivers have to pick one of those. So we could have mandated it. I was particularly against the idea of mandating it because I thought this is a significant change for drivers. You need to bring them along that journey with you. So the first thing we did was contacted those 60 drivers that have got electric cars just to find out how is it for you, basically. Is it working? Would you like it to do it? Would you like to do it again? So we asked them about 10 or 12 questions just to say, what was the selection of vehicles like? What's the range like? What's the public charging network like? Just to get a feel for how it's working for them. And the last question was, given the choices and what you know now, would you do this again? To my surprise, every driver said, yes, I would do it again. So I thought, great, we've got something here. When people are in electric cars, they like it. And despite the charges, the infrastructure challenges at the time, they would do the same again. So it's great to see that when people are in electric cars, they like them and wouldn't go back again. But there's clearly something stopping people from going to electric cars. So we did quite a bit of engagement with the business. Nothing formal, but just as I've been meeting people, just to understand what's stopping you from doing it. And I think there were three main challenges really with it. The first one was about the cost of home chargers. People didn't want to pay what was about £1,000 for home chargers, because by then the government grants had stopped. So we said, well, if we could make that go away, would you be interested? And some people said, yes, they would be. But they didn't want to pay the £1,000. So what, even though you're going to be paying £200-300 a month in benefit in kind, and that's kind of lost money, but you don't want to pay £1,000 for a home charger. And it came down to the fact that it's probably behaviours. People were prepared to pay money for something they wanted, but weren't prepared to pay money for something they didn't want. So, well, I want my BMW petrol car, so I'm prepared to pay for it, but I don't want an electric car, so I don't want to pay for the home charger. So we said, well, if we could make the home charger cost go away somehow, would you be interested? And some more people said, yes, they would be. The next challenge we came across was the cost of public charging and the mileage reimbursement, because the AER rates at the time were sort of 7 or 8p. If you use the public network, it's probably going to cost you 25p. Now, we've got a lot of people that do a lot of business miles within the organisation. So it was going to cost them probably 16, 17p per mile every time they take this out into the public network. So that was clearly a blocker for people as well. So again, we just said the same thing. Well, forget that bit. If we could make that go away somehow, would you be interested? And some more people that you can start to see change in their perceptions a bit. But then you also had the challenge of, well, but there's no point talking to me now because I'm already in a petrol car that's got 3 years left on the lease. Come back and talk to me in 3 years. In other words, I'm gonna push this back as far as I can. So again, it was the same thing. Well, if I could make that disappear, if I could get you into a car tomorrow, would you be interested? And then more people would say yes. So we then thought, well, if those are the three main blockers, well, I can't change now. I'm going to lose money on the public network and I don't want to pay for a home charger. How can we create a policy that will remove those financial barriers? So we came up with the idea that if we could pay for people's home charges, that would get a lot of people on board. If we could also change the mileage reimbursement system, so you're not paying a fixed rate, you're reimbursing people on an average pence per mile, would they be interested? And we also engaged with Navuna, our fleet management partner, to say, look, if we've got a big bulk of orders that we want to try and transition to electric, would you support us on that? So we negotiated a system with Navuna where we could get free of charge early terminations on the cars to gain some traction. We also took advantage of the fact, and timing is a critical part of this with our journey. We took advantage of the fact that a lot of our cars, during and post-COVID, were doing significantly less mileage than we were paying for. So we managed to reschedule our vehicle leases to generate some cash. And what we could then do is reinvest that cash. Because the last thing I wanted to go to our exec committee and say, I've got this great idea and it's going to cost us £1.5 million or whatever the figure would be. So if we could generate some savings through our current leases, to reinvest back into the EV charging, into the EV first policy, that'd be a great way to gain traction with it. So what we were able to do is fund people's home chargers on the business for the decarbonisation fund. We changed the mileage reimbursement scheme so that people are reimbursed an average pence per mile. So essentially what the business does, we pay for all electricity and then the employees pay us back for their private mileage at the average cost. But because they're paying back their private mileage at the average cost, it's in their interest to keep the charging costs as low as they can. So use home charging when they can, then use the workplace charging where they can, but use public charging where they need to. That keeps the cost of the business down, but it also keeps the cost of the individuals down as well. So we came up with the bones of a policy that really helps support drivers in their journey. So we didn't mandate it. It was through encouragement and trying to get drivers on board with this decision. So we launched the policy based on those three key themes, really. And we thought, see how it goes. Now, there was some initial feedback I had from some of the driver population that I was going to be solely responsible for the people that people are going to leave AIM in their droves. I was the reason they're going to find it hard to recruit anybody into the business. I thought, what? By not making you have an electric car, I didn't get it. So, and somebody else referred to me and said, oh, you've clearly not thought this through. Quite a bit of research, actually. So, yes, I have. But irrespective of all the negativity, we launched the policy. And very quickly, we could start to gain some traction with it. Now, one of the things we did as we were launching the policy is we negotiated with BMW and Volvo as well to say that I've had this great idea. We're going to launch an EV first policy. What can you do to help support it? Now, between those two manufacturers, they managed to pre-order 200 cars for me. So that as and when we opened up the order banks, I could get people into cars very quickly. So within a couple of months, we'd gone from 60 cars to 260 because those cars were ready and waiting to go. And what that did is gain some immediate traction in the business. So there was a visible difference. So that as when you're talking to people, then they were already in electric cars. And it was that sort of shift in mindset that really helped to persuade a lot of other people to go that way. So we launched that in the probably middle of 2023. By the time we got to the end of 2023, we already had 35% EVs on the road. By the time we got to the end of 2024, because that traction continued, we were up at 80%. And where we are now today, just turned into the end of 2025, we were just over 92%. And with a few more on order. So I think fairly soon with the current batch of cars on order, within probably 2 years, we'd gone pretty much from 5% to 90%.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europe Car, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europe Car's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europe Karma. Search Europe Car Business.
Richard, that's astounding. And what fascinates me about you is that a lot of organisations who work with government see that they must comply with having electric vehicles on their fleet. And they go into it with almost a negative mindset that says, we've got to do it, chaps. Sorry, so you're going to have them. What you've done is you've used almost this classic sales technique of what's the first objection? How do I overcome that? Sell it back in and then go again and slowly overcome all of the objections until drivers have got nowhere left to go. Why do you care so much? Why are you invested in finding solutions where others just say, you just have to do it?
I think because this is the biggest change that we're likely to see as far as vehicle technology goes in our lifetime. At least I hope it is, because I haven't got the energy to do this again in a couple of years' time if something else comes along. But for me, because it is the biggest change we're likely to see, I don't want to just force it on people, because I know from previous experience, if you force something on drivers, they'll find every reason for it not to work. And we can't afford for this not to work. Aside from the government targets we've got, but for the environmental side of things, this needs to work. And if you can bring people on that journey with you as opposed to just mandate it, it's great. And I think we've seen the results of doing that.
Well, let's pick up on that. The environmental factors, why does that matter to you personally? So, yeah, we get the corporate thing and we understand that you have sustainability targets and government targets and so on to achieve. But it seems that there's something burning inside you, as there is with Paul and I, about this is the right thing to do. Where does that come from?
I was going to say exactly the same phrase. This is the right thing to do. I think irrespective of people's own views on climate change and whether it's man-made or not, it's happening. So we need to try and do something with it. Now, unfortunately, with electric vehicles, it is one of those technologies where it does polarise opinions. And I think it's one of those areas where people have a pre-existing view on this. And there's enough stuff on the internet, be it pro or con, that people can point to something that supports their pre-existing views.
Indeed.
Mm.
So it's about changing people's perceptions on this and not just giving them stuff to read. It's about making them believe this is the right thing to do. And if we look at, and I don't think this is all financial, some of this is behavioural for drivers as well. Because if we recall back when, before we launched the policy, you had some great cars. Things like the Tesla Model 3, the BMW iX3. And that's when benefit in kind was zero. So giving people a free car wasn't enough to convince people. So it's about making them see that the choices that they're making and the impact of it, rather than just saying, you're having this. It was, for me, it was very much about changing behaviours. And that wasn't all of it. I mean, we got people up to 80% very quickly, but it was then, how do we tackle that last 20%? So what we did, that was still a few hundred drivers, whatever 20% of 1,500 is, 300-ish. We then phoned every single driver that we had that hadn't made a decision, just to understand what's stopping you. Some people just wanted a bit more explanation. What's this actually like in the real world for me? If I go with an electric car, how's it going to work? So we were able to give them some help and advice, and we set up an almost like an ambassador network of people that were prepared to talk to people about their experience of the EVs, so that someone could, what's the real life experience? Rather than just Richard as fleet director saying, this is what you're going to have, talk to somebody that actually got it. And once they could talk to people about how it actually works, we then got up to sort of 85%. And then on to 90% fairly quickly. So we found a lot of people just wanted some explanations to what the real world situations are going to be like. Others we knew couldn't make it work, because I know what our population's like. I know how far some people travel. And at the moment, no, it's not feasible for everybody. And that's why I was fairly keen that we don't mandate it, because we knew there was always going to be a population there that can't make this work for them right now. But the bit I've probably enjoyed on this journey is really cutting through the ones that can't make it work. And I've had a lot of conversations with people about electric vehicles and say, yeah, but this, it just won't work for me. Now, I live up in Northwest Cumbria, probably 10 miles north of Workington. I've got 35 miles to get to the nearest motorway. And I travel the length and breadth of the country in my EV. I have done for the last 4.5 years. So I always enjoy those conversations when people say, yeah, but I can't make it work for me. Because if I can make it work, I genuinely don't see a reason why other people can't do. Now, there are some people that can't make it work. Unfortunately, I've got a home charger here. Yeah, some people say, well, yeah, but I, one conversation was, yeah, but I live in the wilds of Hampshire. There's no charging network down here. Well, I'm not aware of any wilds in Hampshire. And also, if you can have a home charger, yeah, you could nearly get to Manchester before you need to charge up. So what's the problem? And some people just don't think it through like that. They just think, I've got to have 100% charge all day, every day, and therefore I can't make it work. So it's been quite interesting taking away those financial barriers to really shine a light on those behaviours and the people that just don't want to change their behaviours. And also the thing I've found quite interesting with some of this as well is the perception I'm getting back from the business. As I mentioned a minute ago, that there was quite a bit of negativity around this to start with. And whenever I join a meeting or a Teams call, there'd be other people on there. And I'd usually have to try and defend the decision. Why are we doing this madness? Why don't we just wait for hydrogen? But over the months that after we'd launched the policy, when there were more people driving electric cars, there'll be other people chipping in to say how it works for them. And the last time it happened was quite interesting, because somebody started on about this madness and this insanity that I've created. And I didn't have to say a word. Everybody else on the call chipped in and explained why he was in the wrong.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that person could just very quickly realize, actually, I'm in the minority now.
Hmm.
So I'm going to shut up.
Yeah.
And I've not had it since then.
Oh, that's brilliant. Richard, I mean, I got quite excited when you said MODEC. So MODEC, I know, but MODEC was a vehicle totally ahead of its time.
It was.
And what it showed me was that you guys as Amy Construction have been on this journey a long time, and you've been thinking, how do we decarbonize for a long time? The ESG, or the environment, social, governance strategy of your business that has sort of been handed to you on a plate by government, by the sounds of it, you know, like there's the gun, there's the pen, get on and sign something up, please. But MODEC was sort of before all of that. So what is the commercial journey? I'd love to hear a little bit if you have any anecdotes or stories or experiences about MODEC, because our good friend Roger Atkins was the sales director at the time. I don't know if you ever stumbled across him, but Roger was and loves commercial vehicles, but he's much more of a battery and a generalist these days. But talk to me a little bit about the journey on the commercial vehicle side.
Yeah, well, the commercial vehicle side has been interesting. Like you say, MODEC, it didn't really work in the long term, but I think, as you said, they were ahead of the time. I mean, visually, the thing was a space-age-looking vehicle with a rounded front. A driver would sit in the middle. But the drivers loved them. We had them on a few contracts. We did some work for TfL in the North region, and we maintained the roads there. In that city centre environment, even best part of 20 years ago, so I think it was about 2006-07 time we put those in, the drivers loved them and they did what we needed them to do. It was great. Unfortunately, after the MODEC, the choice of electric commercial vehicles wasn't great. So we did sort of stumble away through this. We tried a few things like the hydrogen Berlingos and electric Berlingos on one of the contracts in Sheffield just to see how they went. But the feedback on the hydrogen wasn't great, so they wanted to go with electric more. But there's very few sort of takers across the Amy population an operating contract perspective that really wanted electric vehicles because they used the diesels, didn't really understand electrics and so on. So when we come to the commercial vehicle side of things, we took the view, let's focus on cars first of all. Then once cars are up and running, let's bring the attention to the commercial vehicles. And that's where we are now. That the commercial vehicle side of things has been quite interesting because when it started off a couple of years ago, we started looking at commercial vehicles. And the view we were getting from our contract directors and operations managers was, I don't want it. This won't work for me. You're going to grind my business to a halt. I'm going to have all my drivers on charge for hours every day. I've briefly explained earlier the environments that we work in. Now, some probably worth understanding, the financial penalties we get for not delivering our service are quite staggering. There were some city centre environments we had at that time where we needed to empty litter bins. Now, in a pedestrian zone in one of the city centres. Now, if the council phoned us to say, or a member of the public phoned to say, that bin's full, we had an hour to empty it. If we didn't empty the bin within an hour, it was a £500 fine per bin per hour. Until you get to 24 hours, and it was £40,000 per bin per day. We've got some... I think you're probably aware of the Highways Agency Traffic Officer vehicles in England.
Yes.
We operate that service on behalf of Transport Scotland in Scotland. So it's 3.5-ton vans that run around with variable messaging, signs, CCTV cameras, everything else. So probably £50,000-£60,000 worth of kit we've got fitted onto a 3.5-ton van. Every day one of those is off the road, we face £5,000 a day fines from Transport Scotland. So as you can imagine, when I'm trying to talk to those operations managers about converting their vans to electric, they get very nervous because the financial pressures that we've got against operational service delivery. So what we first started to find when we talked about commercial vehicle fleet is, I don't want it. It's going to grind my business to a halt. I'm going to have drivers on charge all day, every day. It's just not going to work for me. By focusing our efforts on the company car fleet over the last couple of years, those operations managers and contract directors inadvertently have now been in electric cars themselves for the last 18 months, 2 years. So they know the realities of how it is to work with an electric vehicle. But what I'm finding, and as an analogy I use, I call it the clay layer. Now, going back from my construction days, if you imagine digging a hole in the ground, the first bit, the topsoil bit, is easy to get through. And I classify that as sort of our exec senior directors. Easy to get through. They want to do the right thing. You then hit clay and nothing gets through that clay layer. And that's really where our contract directors are sitting and operations managers, because trying to get them to move their position on it has been difficult. Beneath clay, you then get into easy soil again. And that's our driver population. We know that when drivers have got electric vans, they love them. One of our contracts in Sheffield, we put some Transit 3.5-tonners in there. One of the guys was dead against having an electric van. 2 weeks after he had it delivered, we went back up to interview the guy to see how he's getting on with it. And he absolutely loves it. One of his duties in the summer is to go around the city centre watering the flowers at 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And he says, I could go around the city in stealth mode. No one knows I'm here. So he absolutely loves it. So you think, well, okay, well, the exec senior directors want to do it. We then hit the clay layer, and then we get to the driver population that like it. So the battle with that is, how do we get through that clay layer? And that clay layer has an ability to shift its argument as well. So originally it was, you're going to grind my business to a halt. Now they know the realities of what it's like to live with an EV themselves. The debate shifted a little bit into, yeah, but we do so many things, I can't make it work. We do too many miles. We're on emergency support. So looking at a contract recently, you've got 50 vans up there. I can't shift any of them because we're doing emergency support. Okay, you do emergency support with those 6 vehicles. What about the other 44? If it, Bert lives a long way away. Okay, we'll take Bert's van out of it, 43. And they run out of excuses on that as well. But unfortunately, with the transition to electric vans, we are at a time where the financially it is difficult because we're trying to replace vehicles that were funded in 2018, 2019, 5-6 years ago, when manufacturing costs were lower, discounts with manufacturers were higher, interest rates were significantly lower. And unfortunately, we're now in that time where we're trying to replace old diesel vehicles with new electric. And people are looking at the price difference. So, well, I'm paying £100 for a diesel vehicle. My new electric one's going to cost around £160 a week. Electric's expensive. I don't want it. Without realizing, well, actually, your new diesel van's going to cost you the same.
Yeah, it's going to be the same. Yeah.
But we're struggling at the minute to get people on board with that argument to say that this isn't because of the move to electric. This is replacing old to new rather than diesel to electric. So we're very much in that situation at the moment.
Yeah, the reality is, Richard, I think, is the longer we wait, the more expensive diesel will get. Because at the end of the day, it's the scale of volume. So the less you sell, the more expensive it becomes to sell each one. And so on. We've got the scale of economics. And I'm very, very clear that actually commercial vehicles are becoming, assuming no downtime, no additional downtime, what's been the experience? Because you mentioned downtime there and the possible risk of £5,000 or £40,000 or £500 a bin and all that sort of stuff. My experience and the experience of many is that the electric vehicles, broadly speaking, are less off the road. Is that your experience generally from a maintenance perspective?
Yes, it is. Yes. So again, it's one of those things that once you've got an electric vehicle, people can see the benefits of it. But it's that blocker again, stopping people from making that leap. So yes, I exactly agree with what you've said then. Once we've got electric vehicles, the performance is better, they're more reliable, but it's just getting people to make that leap. And unfortunately, the financial side of things, whilst we can demonstrate to them that their new diesel van would be more expensive than a new electric one, we're still trying to get over that budgetary pressure of replacing a 5 or 6 year old vehicle with a new one. And that's the hardest bit we're trying to find at the minute. We are making some progress. I think we're already up to about 20% of our commercial vehicle fleet is electric. We've got another 120-ish that are due to be delivered early part of this year. So we're probably around 25% now. But I want to make more progress on that side of things. We have got a mixture of challenges because we work in a number of different locations. The majority of the progress has been made on vehicles where we are depot-based. So highways contracts, for example, most of those vehicles are depot-based. They go from a depot and come back to a depot. When we get into the rail sector and also our facilities management side of things, you've got a lot more in the way of home workers, people traveling from home to a work site, and then maybe go around 2 or 3 different work sites during the course of a day and then back home. So it's then how do you keep those people mobile? Do you start investing in home chargers? Now, we've obviously got evidence from the company car fleet that investing in home chargers is a good thing. Some people don't do it, but we've always taken the view that see it as an opportunity rather than the cost. Because if you can get somebody on a low pence per kilowatt rate and charge at home, that home charge is going to pay for itself within a couple of thousand miles. So why wouldn't you do it? And that's the approach we took on the company car fleet. And we're also starting to take that approach on the commercial vehicle fleet as well, that you've only got to do 3 or 4 thousand miles and the things pay for itself rather than using a public charge at 75-80p a kilowatt. But then it's overcoming those challenges that not everybody's got the ability to have a home charger. So what do you do with some of those? So we're looking at temporary charging solutions as well. And we've got a lot of contracts that are long term, but we've got a lot of contracts that are shorter term. Now, because of the nature of what we do, we work pretty much exclusively at client locations. Now, our Sheffield Highways contract is great. It's a 25-year contract. So we're in that depot. We can do what we need to do to it. But other contracts that we've got are 2 to 3 years, or they're on a run out for 2 to 3 years. So how do we electrify that fleet? And it's all too easy to say, well, that contract's only got 3 years left, so let's not do anything. That's not the right answer. The right answer is still invest in replacing that fleet, because in 2-3 years' time when that contract finishes, I can move those vehicles to another part of the business rather than just do nothing. But then that's where the charging infrastructure comes in. So looking at charging solutions at the minute, the temporary that we can move from one site to another is great, rather than the sort of fixed EV chargers. But it is more difficult. Yeah, the company car fleet was good. There were some specific challenges on there that we managed to overcome through the policy. But the commercial vehicle fleet, there are a lot of different nuances to it. So it's a bit more challenging. And then when we come to the heavy goods fleet as well, that's another area altogether. Obviously, we're keeping in touch with the manufacturer, but what we do with alternative fuel technology, we've got some 7-ton dailies on the fleet that we're using for some of the city centre works, which are going okay. But it's then as we get into the bigger stuff, and that's when cost really is quite a feature to this as well. We've looked at whether we take an interim step such as HVO, but again, there's issues over the sustainability of feedstock. So we haven't made a public position on that yet, but I think our view is let's not go full steam ahead with HVO, because whilst you solve one problem, it potentially creates another. So I think my approach, again, with things like HVO, is even if we did it, it's not the answer. But people would see it as the answer. Great, we've done it.
It's a stepping stone.
My view is, even if we did it, it's a stepping stone, exactly what you said then, to get to zero emission technology. And that's where we need to be focusing on our efforts. And I've never been a fan of aftermarket conversions. My view is once the likes of a Mercedes come to market with something, you know it's going to be credible, as opposed to somebody doing an aftermarket conversion. Yeah.
I don't know how there are enough hours in the day for what you do, but I always like to get behind the job title and the work that you do, Richard, to understand a little bit about the human being who's doing all of this. And I notice in the background, there are one or two instruments.
I always ask that question. If I don't do what I say, that's what it is.
I usually ask, how do you relax? I suspect you give them a good airing.
I generally, so I go down to that end of the office. And
How many guitars do you have?
I think it's around, I don't know. I think it's around 15. I don't use them all.
Is it an addiction?
It's hard to say no, but I don't think it is.
You ask someone with 15 of anything, if you've got an addiction, they're going to say no, but really.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And what sort of guitar music do you play? What do you like to play?
Well, I started off learning classical guitar when I was 8, and there's still a classical guitar in the middle there that I've had since it was new in 1984. So that's 42 years old. So I started learning classical guitar from the age of 8. I did that for 6 years, took lessons in some of my grades. And then at the young age of 14, somebody introduced me to punk rock music, and it all went downhill from there.
Now, there's a revelation. I didn't see that coming.
Absolutely. Stroppy teenager, that was me. So since then, I've done anything really, be it sort of punk rock music, folk music, classical, orchestral stuff. I was even in a musical once as well, doing Cliff Richard and the Shadows.
No way.
Don't tell anyone that though, please.
Oh, Hank Marvin himself.
Well, I've always moved between guitar and bass as well, so it's always good to try and use different instruments. But no, I just enjoy doing that. I always have them.
And of course, you'll be one of those incredibly annoying musicians who can just play anything. Give me the music and I can do it. Can you play by ear as well?
Yes.
Oh, is there anything you can't do? Seriously?
Yeah, but it was quite useful learning classical stuff, because that's a good grounding, because it teaches you to read music as well as be able to pick things up by ear. And I don't play live anymore. I haven't done that for a few years because I'm, again, part of the downside of living Northwest Cumbria. The music scene up here isn't great. But I just enjoy it, even for myself. Just it's a great way to relax. Just half an hour at the end of the day, just pick one of those up. And just it's a way to switch off from this.
Take some discipline, though, doesn't it? It really does take some discipline to stop your working day and make that transition to anything. I've started to read for the first time in 20 years. I have a book with me right now, and I'll read that at the end of the day to get myself in a better frame of mind before I go and do what my wife tells me. It really is important.
It is, Paul. Yeah. And it is like a discipline, like you say. It's like going to the gym, which I don't do that because I spend my time down there rather than go to gym. But you have to get into the habit. Even practicing for half an hour a day, it's a habit. Once you get out of it, it's harder to get back into it. So that's what I find, that getting a new guitar is always that kickstart into that habit.
I'm getting bored. I better get a new one.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I can,
then I can
learn it again. Yeah.
Exactly right. So,
But it's true, isn't it, though? Because, I mean, my daily habit that is working really well for me is walking. So I'm getting out every morning. I always put a LinkedIn post every Sunday morning now for the Sunday morning walkers. Just kind of my pontifications on the week and musings and whatnot. But I also find that it's really good for my mental health. And obviously in a busy and challenging world that you're in right now with constant challenges, right? You know, you've navigated the challenge of cars, and you've literally picked up the phone to hundreds of drivers and had those negotiations. Some of them will be slightly harder than others. And then now you're dealing with the clay layer in the commercial vehicle world. And then you've got to think about heavy commercial vehicles. I suppose a little smattering of good news at time of recording was some extra grants. I don't know if you're able to take advantage of those, but is mental health something that you kind of attribute to what you do behind you? Because I know that more and more of us are considering this now. Is that your
support? It is. I think for me personally, that is a great way for me to switch off from this. Otherwise, you're focusing on this all the time. But one thing that has been a key part of it, particularly on the commercial vehicle, on the company car side of things, but it's going to be equally relevant on the commercial vehicle fleet, is the mental health of drivers. Because as I said earlier, this is the biggest change I'd like to go through. And one of the things that I'd probably do slightly differently to start with, through purely lack of knowledge, is how we engage with the neurodiverse community that we've got within the business. Because we've got 11,000 people within the business, probably 4,000 drivers, probably a bit more than that, 1,500 car drivers, however many drivers are on a commercial vehicle fleet, that there are people that accept things in different ways. And you can't just tackle everybody in the same approach. So one of the team has been engaged with that neurodiverse network, because we have a various affinity groups within AIMEE. So let's make sure we're engaging with that community to make sure they understand what we're trying to do, and get any feedback from them as to how we need to tailor our communications to suit them. So yeah, absolutely. That's been probably something I would do differently to start with, because that probably caught me off guard partway through the policy, where I'd realised we hadn't considered that community.
But you're still leading the way. That's fantastic. I mean, because a lot of businesses haven't wrestled with that at all.
No.
No, you're right, John. But I'm curious, Richard, what do you think you would do differently? Just be more intentional earlier, or specifically your approach?
I think probably just be more intentional to start with. So let's make sure we engage with some of those communities beforehand. I'd not even considered, I'm ashamed to say, I've not even given it a thought that this population are going to accept this in a different way. I'd do that differently. Make sure we're engaging with the different populations to start with, I think so.
It's fantastic, isn't it? It really, really is important. And Richard, it's exciting. What's exciting at the moment? I'm toying between what's most exciting at the moment and what are you most proud of in your journey so far. But let's go with what are you most proud of so far in the journey.
I think getting to our target of 90%+, 3 years ahead of when we thought we were going to get there. That for me shows that something worked in what we did, and that time and investment with engaging with people and the approach that we've taken has paid off. So I think I'm probably proud of the way the business has already stepped up to say that, okay, let's invest in this, let's do it properly rather than just band-aid it. So I particularly felt exposed at one point because it was me that specifically said, I don't want to mandate this. And then, okay, well, go and make it happen somehow. That's a good idea. So I think I'm probably personally quite pleased that we didn't mandate it, but also really proud of the fact that the achievements really speak for themselves in the way we've tackled this policy.
And John, I think this kind of really, I don't know, kind of advocates our role within this sector, because we can't demand, but we just try and get that information out, don't we, and engage and do that. But it's great to see it in practice, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful, because we're just talking heads, but this guy is out there making a difference. And I was sitting here thinking, I wonder, does Richard Guy wear his pants on the outside of his trousers? Because he totally is.
Stand up this instant.
Listen, when I said I'm happy to share anything with you on this interview, there are some limits. But tackling behaviours have been probably the bit I've enjoyed most with this, really, because as I said earlier, by removing those financial barriers, we've been able to shine a light on people's behaviours with this and change some of their perceptions. And there's been some great conversations I've had with people. And without giving any names away, one person told me during this, I'm not going to go to electric. It's too much. Why is that? Well, a friend of mine's got an electric vehicle and he was coming home the other week and ran out of electric quarter of a mile from home. And the car was so heavy, blocked the high street. I don't want that to happen to me. And I didn't know him particularly well at the time, but every bit of me inside, and it wasn't the environment to say it either, but every bit of me inside said, if your friend had run out of petrol quarter of a mile from home, you'd be laughing at him and pointing and calling him an idiot. You wouldn't be saying, I'm never going to drive a petrol car. So people have got that. And I think there's a lot of continued negativity in the press, which doesn't help with this, because people can point to something that, as I said, can support their pre-existing views. So if you don't want electric, you can point to all these press articles of bad news stories. And I've not known that really in any other application, but they seem to have a negativity on EVs. But I think cutting through all that behavioural stuff has really helped us to gain traction on the policy. And that's been a particularly enjoyable part of it for me.
Brilliant.
So we're sitting here with much of 2026 still ahead of us. What's the focus for Richard Guy? Is it vans? Is it trucks? Is it something else? What are you looking forward to delivering this year?
For me in the business, I think the focus has got to be on the light commercial vehicle fleet, the vans. We've got a significant portion of our vans are small two-seat vans, and there's enough product in the marketplace to do that. We've got some vehicles, a lot of our vehicles are sort of 3.5-ton size. Product in the market is getting there, but probably towards the back end of this year, early part of next year, it's going to be there. So for me, it's about picking which parts of the fleet we can do. And it's not going to be everything, but it's going to be look at the vehicle telemetry data. Which vehicles are working at depots? Which ones are working from home? Who could have a home charger and who can't? So it's about picking off those easy wins, I think, for me through 2026. Rather than trying to do everything, do what we can and leave the other stuff until later on when the technology catches up. So for me, the focus is that's small to medium van side of things. If some of our emergency support vehicles are using 3.5-ton panel vans and the stuff's not in the market now, doesn't mean we can't do it. It just means we can't do it yet. So do what we can do and focus on the bigger stuff later on. But also I've been, from the operational side of things, very keen to try and make people look at changing the operational practices in line with the change of technology. If most of our sites try and do what we're currently doing today with an electric vehicle, it won't always work. So looking at some of the smaller vans, can you make do with a car instead? Do you need a larger van? Can you make do with a smaller van? And that's what we've tried to tackle it. Probably one of the first contracts we did electric was our city centre environment in Sheffield, which is great. But you're working for Sheffield City Council. It's a fairly discrete geographical area. So if a van goes 6 miles each way from a depot, that's about as far as they go. Lots of mileage inside that area, but it's not particularly far. The other contract we focused on was our contract with Transport Scotland on the South West Trunk Road Network. And that contract goes from the borders at Carlisle through to Glasgow, all the way over to Ayr and Stranraer. They've made it work with some of their fleet, but they've made it work by looking at their routes, changing the routes, rather than trying to make somebody do a 300-mile round trip in a diesel vehicle. Well, do part of it one day, do part of it another day, rather than trying to do it all in one day. So changing the operational practices in line with the change of technology. So yes, focus for 2026 is very much on the light commercial vehicle fleet. We'll keep an eye on what's happening in the plant world, because again, we've got a plant on our sites loading shovels, telehandlers and so on. And also the truck side of things. But for me, that's later. That's probably 2027 time.
It's fascinating. And I love the opportunity that we have here to talk to you about the journey that you're on and the experience that you're having. It just is just so insightful. And obviously we've got one eye on the commercial vehicle show coming up, and we might have to get you along. Might have to get you along and come and talk for us.
Yeah, anyway, that'd be fine. Happy to do that.
Well, Richard, listen, we have a closing tradition on the podcast, because every podcast of any kind of consequence has a closing tradition, and ours is the EV Cafe magic wand.
Oh, I see.
This is the one you should have had, not the lump of wood.
Yeah, the stick of wood. I think it's just a 4x2
improvisation. 4x2. No. Improviser, exactly. So no, you have this with full lightning bolt, and it is coming in your general direction right now across the airwaves.
Thank you.
And there you go. That's it. So you now have the proper a magic wand. And with this magic wand, Richard, you get to have one wish. And that one wish you can do anything with. What would be that one wish right here, right now?
Change the narrative in the mainstream media. Because I think it is so negative at the minute, and it doesn't need to be. The realities are very different from how the press portrays it, but unfortunately what they will do is amplify odd examples and make people believe that is the reality.
And it's so true, and such a blooming shame. I'm a part of a WhatsApp group that is constantly being, you know, updating with the latest nonsense that comes out, you know, via our mainstream media. I will say it's getting less a little bit if the regularity of posts, and we are seeing slightly positive stories from time to time, and I think certainly the Fleet Press is improving. But oh boy, that you're absolutely right. Many of your clay layer will be hearing those negative stories all of the time. And you've said it many times. If we have an opinion, we can go and validate that opinion, be it good or be it bad. And it's that old adage, isn't it? If you think you can or you think you can't, you are probably right.
Absolutely.
And the mainstream media will assist you in your belief system.
Exactly right.
Whichever it is.
You can point to the good news stories if you want to. You can point to the bad news stories and you'll cling on to those.
Absolutely.
I think until that stops, and it's great. I think it has improved, like you say. There's a lot more adverts on television now for electric vehicles, which is great. So that's going to start to shift people's views on it. But I think as long as we're amplifying the negative examples, the one bad news story, and I think I read one a few months ago. I don't often read them because it just infuriates me. But there was one I thought, I will read this, because it was all about a person hands his electric car back and goes back to diesel because of the charging infrastructure. And this comes through my sort of daily news feed. And it wasn't until you get to the end of it. Man in Ethiopia hands electric car back. But we've clung on to that. And that was the thing.
That's priceless.
But you had to read.
Man in Ethiopia.
Yeah, but you had to read almost through to the end to see exactly where it was.
Oh my gosh. Think, how does that get to be a headline?
Point? Yeah, what is the point?
Oh dear.
So I think that would be my one wish, is to change the narrative in the press, because irrespective of whether people like us or not, this is coming. And that was probably where I had to change people's perception internally and Amy to start with, because it was, why am I doing this? It was seen as my idea. Well, not, this is legislation. This is here. It's happening whether you like it or not. So get on board whilst the support is here from the business to help you do it.
Indeed. John, this has been fascinating and very encouraging. I love the fact that no mandate required. I think that's brilliant.
Doesn't it speak to Richard, though, in that he's that calm, self-assured, confident, quietly passionate, but really educated mind that just, there's nowhere to go with him. It's a case of, you know, he'll present the position. Here's the rationale. Here's the data. Why wouldn't you do it? And it's infuriatingly brilliant for the naysayers, I'm sure, who just want to beat him with a stick and say, because I say so. But actually, he's just a wonderful, passionate human being who's doing darn good stuff. And I wish, do you know what, there aren't very many podcasts that I get to the end of an hour and think, I could go again. But Richard is one of those where, yeah, I'd do another hour.
I'm going to record that last 30 seconds and keep it. Thank you.
Use it for your review.
Absolutely, yeah.
But do you know what? The thing that has struck me throughout this, and it struck me in your approach, Richard, is that do we really need the ZEV mandate? Or is there a better way? And now, I don't want to unwrap that particular can of worms. So let's keep the can of worms there, over there. But it just struck me that if we invested a little bit more in our approach, in the way that we communicate, would we really need the ZEV mandate at all? For cars, I think. Maybe for vans, I think, is a bit harder because it's easier to do what we've always done there because of operational requirements and all of that sort of stuff. But in the car world, with tech being what tech is, and there is some great tech out there and there's some lovely vehicles, and is it a better approach, yours? It's clearly worked for Amy and it's thrilling to see the results.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked for us. Having the ZEV mandate behind me helped to explain why we're doing this. And this isn't just a crazy idea that I've come up with. So that helped me gain some traction to say that this is coming whether you want it or not. So it gave us that impetus to start the policy. But you're right. I think if there was a great clip I saw of, I think it was Rory Sutherland or someone like that a few months ago, talking about if you did this in reverse, it's crazy that we've all been driving petrol cars for so many years. Mm. So yeah, I think a lot of it is about education and perception. And yes, if you got that bit right, you probably wouldn't need the ZEV mandate because people would be doing it because, yeah, most of our driver population wouldn't go back again. We've had a few that couldn't make it work and a couple, but again, that sort of thing has built a bit of momentum. Sometimes here, but we had loads of people hand their electric cars back. 3 out of 1,350 is not loads. and two of those lived up in the northeast of Scotland. And so, yes, you can find the infrastructure a bit difficult there. But so no, I think you're right. With education, we probably wouldn't need the ZEV mandate because why wouldn't you do it? The cars are better. It's a better driving experience. It makes you stop on a long journey that I never used to do. I used to drive one end of the country as long as the traffic was going. I used to drive absolutely fine. Having an electric car makes me stop, which is safer.
I've got the headline for this. You don't need the ZEV mandate. You need a better fleet guy. Richard Guy.
Yeah, because that'll infuriate everybody else in the industry now. So.
Oh, yeah, you know, we can't do that. No.
It's having infuriation.
And then just put in brackets, or girl. Dear me. Yeah. Well, before we dig into getting into any more trouble, listen, Richard, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great. We've really learned a lot. And I think we can all walk away with an air of positivity about the future of electric cars. A real great hope and optimism for the world of vans and trucks, because you've done such a good job with the cars. Surely the vans and trucks will follow. It's great news. And everybody, listen, connect with Richard on LinkedIn. You can follow the journey of Amy there as well. You know, you'll find Amy Fleet Department. Do you have your own page on LinkedIn, or is it just Amy?
No, it's just part of Amy. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So follow Amy and just watch their journey and see how it's done. It's been great to spend some time with you today, Richard. Thank you so much. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we've spoken to many fleet managers across the couple of years that we've been doing this and many other inspirational characters. So get over to the EV Cafe page and check out the podcasts that are there and everything else. And hopefully, maybe see you at the CV show. Richard might be there. You can ask him some questions yourself. In the meantime, have a great day, everybody.